This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
Episode of Comics in Black and White. We're finally in double digits, and with me today is our second recurring guest, one of our new regulars, Jay Loving. He was with me on the Love and Rockets episode a few episodes back, and we'll have more Love and Rockets plus many other good things in the future. And joining us as a special guest this week is Garrett Spellman. This week about Punk Rock Jesus. We've actually planned out far ahead enough that you guys have known that for a couple episodes at least, so hopefully some of you have picked it up right along. It's not as heavy as some of the reads, lengthwise at least, as was it 6 issues, Jay?
6 issues originally, yeah, published by Vertigo.
Yeah, so I think I mentioned this to you before, Jay, but this was actually one of the first comics that was recommended to me when I started getting into comics. I had been getting a few things, some Batman, some X-Men, but when I went to the first comic shop that I went to, they were having a sell. And I said, you know, I'm getting these things, but I just want something different, so suggest anything. The first thing they actually suggested to me was Punk Rock Jesus. Found out later it's because Sean Murphy, who did the art for Punk Rock Jesus, is in Maine. He actually lives, like, down the street from the store. So they had a good relationship with him, which is part of the reason why they were hyped on it. I didn't check it out then. I didn't check it out until you wanted to do it for this episode, but I'm glad I finally did check it out. I like Sean Murphy from his other art. It's good to read something that he wrote, too.
Right.
So you're the one that led us to this book, Jay. Why did you want to do this?
Several reasons, some of which are quite selfish in the fact that, number one, Sean Murphy is an artist I admire tremendously. In fact, I will go, you'll hear me say things like, he's my favorite artist working in comics, in contemporary comics today. I think he's one of the most amazing artists and gifted artists. And he's, what I think we see through Punk Rock Jesus, he also has a good storytelling ability.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed with his writing, because I don't even know of anything else that he's written.
I agree, yeah.
Some of his very early work, I'm trying to think of the name of it.
Like his early indie stuff?
Early stuff he did, he wrote right out of college.
He's currently doing the art for Tokyo Ghost, which I actually just read the first 7 issues of today. I'd read some of it before, but I picked up the trade and I had a couple of floppies too, so I just blew through a bunch of it. Other than that, is he currently doing any other titles? Do you know, Jay?
He is supposed to be doing, I haven't heard when it's going to be out, he's supposed to be doing the artwork for an arc of All-Star Batman.
And Scott Snyder. His own.
Don't know, I have not heard when that's going to be coming out, but he's slated to do that at some point. Or he
That'll
was.
Be interesting.
If that has changed, I haven't heard, but He's put out some teaser drawings on Twitter. I follow him on Twitter, and he's put out some different drawings. In fact, Garrett, you've even seen some of that, and you've posted it out on the Slack channel. So when that comes out, I don't know. But I'm really looking forward to that. But I haven't seen any.
So it sounds like that should be coming up soon. Aside from that, he's done, it looks like, mostly DC and Vertigo work. In the back of this book, it says that he's done titles such as Batman Scarecrow, Year One, Teen Titans, Joe the Barbarian, Hellblazer, and the miniseries American Vampire: Survival of the Fittest. So he's one of your favorite, if not your favorite, modern comic artist. I definitely put him up there. What other reasons did you want to do this book, Jay?
I just think it's a very seminal work. I've heard people say that this belongs in the same category as Watchmen, as far as how it influenced comics. I don't know if I've put it as far as that much of a game changer, but bottom line, it's a damned intelligent book, I think.
Yeah, and it really is, the way it's woven together.
And I like that. I mean, this, comics run in all gamuts. Some of you have your lighter type fare, and then you have something that's, but this is just, can be really dense at times. I like some of the other things I like and that you like, I know, Paul. So I thought this would be something that would be good to share with people that listen to this podcast and, maybe bring some other people into this world and in reading some of what Murphy has done, and reading some of the comics that are more, you know, that aren't afraid to look at some of the, you know, darker sides of human existence, and 'cause you see a lot of that in this book. I mean, it really is not, you know, it's not a fun book.
Yeah, it's a very thought-provoking, heavy book, and it is one of those books. I mean, this really fits what our purpose for the show is, but it's also a very new book, and I don't think we've done a lot of books that have been very recent in this show yet. And Sean Murphy, of course, has a pretty good name, so this, I mean, if anybody's checking this out because we're talking about Sean Murphy and talking about Punk Rock Jesus, I mean, they may know Sean Murphy but not have known this because they didn't go back when, I think he really got his name really big out there with Tokyo Ghost, but I think this was kind of the start of it where he was really making a name for himself. So hopefully this will open up people's eyes to, you know, to look at stuff differently and not be turned off by a book just because there's not color on the page and that sort of thing. So Garrett, you wanted to join us. You asked to join us for this episode. What was it about this that that intrigued you?
Honestly, I am really into Sean Murphy's art, and I've heard a lot about it. I really, really like punk comics, and so that drew me to it also. And I mean, Jay, he turned me on to Love and Rockets as well, so that's another punk comic. But yeah, it's really impressive, all of Sean's work. And yeah, he's, like I said, or like Jay said, he's also writing an upcoming Batman arc. So I figure may as well get myself familiar with his work, and it's good stuff. I mean, I say in the Slack channel that I don't like scratchy art, but Sean Murphy, he's definitely an exception.
Yeah, he's got quite a style to his art. The name has slipped my mind, but the colorist who does the colors on Tokyo Ghost, I was looking, I just, this couple days, or yesterday actually, was my anniversary. So my wife and I went out, and we went to down in Portland, and we got sushi, and then we kind of went shopping around, and I stumbled across some really good deals on comics on my anniversary. That's pretty awesome. And I got the omnibus of Matt Fraction and David Aja's Hawkeye. And I had started reading Tokyo Ghost at that time, and the colors in Tokyo Ghost always really stood out to me, and I realized that the colorist was the same colorist that did Hawkeye, and I looked a little bit more, and not only has he done those two, but he's Seven to Eternity also, which I haven't read yet, but it's also written by Rick Remender, which Tokyo Ghost is, and then the colors are just amazing in both of those. Those colors with Sean Murphy's art are just amazing. I really love the combo of those two.
It's Matt Hollingsworth is the colorist.
Matt Hollingsworth, that's it. Yeah, I can remember the Holling, and I knew that wasn't the last name, but yeah, he's really good. I was talking with Nick Wetmore about him, and Nick said that he is his second favorite colorist. And he gave me a whole big list of colorists that he loves. I forget who he said was number one off the top of my head, but yeah, he's fantastic. And it's funny, you notice those details between comics when you really start spreading out, reading different things, and people point out certain details. Like, we all read Valiant Comics, Baron, for example. You start to realize that any book that David Baron colors is just really, really well colored, and it really adds something to the book. So Matt Hollingsworth really adds that too, but he just looks great with Sean Murphy's art. So now that we've talked about everything but the story of this book, let's dive in. Jake, you want to kick us off? What is this book about?
Well, the concept of this book is, the centric theme is that this network or entertainment conglomerate named Ophis, which I think is probably patterned off of Fox Entertainment, right? Some of the bigger, you know, entertainment conglomerates, has come up with an idea for a new reality TV show. They have claimed, they have retrieved, the Catholic Church has given them permission to examine the Shroud of Turin, and they have retrieved the DNA of Jesus Christ, and they're going to clone an infant, and that will be this reality show. We'll be watching this infant and his grow up with his mother and other characters. They're living in a secure enclosed compound, and we see a lot of but the other primary character, who I think is actually the actual primary character of the story, is Thomas, who's from Ireland, former member of the Irish Republican Army, who has come to America trying to escape his past. He's trying to distance himself from his involvement in the IRA, because I won't go into details, but as we see in the story and as it unfolds, he has pretty horrendous things in his past that he's trying to get past, that he feels like he needs redemption and forgiveness for. And that sort of drives what he does, his actions all through. And he becomes the head of security, but of this project that you call J2. But he also has become, you know, he's pledged himself as to be the protector of this young infant who's ostensibly the clone of Jesus Christ, who they name Chris. But he becomes his protector. And it really becomes a story about him, I think, in how he progresses through the story. So that's the main conceit.
Yeah, I think that I think Thomas is really the heart of the theme of the story, whereas Chris is the character that drives just the story. A variety of different ideals from people. You have this media conglomerate that's just looking for ratings and to make money, basically. And so they think of, let's clone Jesus and raise him to be Jesus. You see a lot of the public reaction to stuff, and without getting into politics any specifically, but just with everything that's going on nowadays, and reading this, and seeing the commentary it's making on the social side of things, it just stands out even more than when this was written. Right. The same thing with Tokyo Go. Some of the comments they made that you look in the perspective of today, and it's almost like they saw more chaotic times coming.
Right.
And, I mean, the other progression we've been making in the world is just things getting more and more chaotic. So I think it just goes to speak, though, that these concepts and ideals that they're talking about in a book like this, they're much more universal to being tied to any kind of specific time. And obviously with this story, it's not exactly tethered down to a specific time. I think just about the only complaint I had in the storytelling in this is they never really make you feel rooted to where you are in the grand of things, time-wise, what the world is like. And at times that gets a little confusing, like when they're in like Manhattan or something like that, but it's like a lawless flood zone. They didn't set that up at all. That's about the only complaint I have about this book, is some of those things weren't set up. It's just you run into them, you're like, okay, well, I guess this is how things are. But aside from that, the storytelling was just great, and the way I had expressed to you, Jay, that really on the fence about it, because I felt like it was going too strong in one direction. But then as it just kept on progressing, they really threw the balance off one way, but then they pulled it back. And they did a lot of that, just pushing the balance back and forth where you can never really feel everything and it comes to a conclusion. So let's see. So we talked about they clone from the Shroud of Turin, supposedly. What is this guy's name? The head
Slate.
Of J2?
Slate.
Yeah. He's a key character through this whole book, and he's a real bastard.
Yes, he is.
We also get a little bit of Thomas's backstory first. So you see his parents getting killed, and his uncle bringing him to the IRA to do right by his dad. That sets up Thomas, and then you jump into J2 and what they're doing, and they do a pretty good job, because, I mean, this book is spanning 16 years, basically, because the character Chris is 15 at the end of the book, and he was not yet born at the beginning of the book.
Roughly 15 years. I think.
So you're getting a lot of, you know, J2, the protests against them. They set the tone of Thomas really strongly. They get the plan. They ask the doctor to manipulate DNA to make this Christ clone look more like people want him to look.
Blue eyes, yep.
So already there, you can see that the motivation of Ophis is purely commercial. I mean, they don't care about truth at all. Like, the reason they say they're doing this is totally false. They're just doing it to get the ratings. A lot of character building in the beginning. There's a lot of characters they got to build.
Murphy put some stuff in there that's sort of subtle, but criticisms. For example, Ophis, that's the Greek word for serpent. So he's obviously, you know, giving his opinion of this network conglomerate here by giving him this name. And that Greek word, that's the same Greek word that appears in a lot of biblical translations for serpent. So, I mean, he's you know, he's playing with all of these elements. And I'm just saying, you know, I was going to reiterate your point, because it's about halfway through the book where Chris breaks off and becomes this punk rocker, where it really looks like, and this is where you started having some trepidation, and it really looked like it's going to become just this harangue against, you know, certain things, and it's going to become this heavy-handed just criticism of bashing of everything, you know, of this organized religion. But to Murphy's credit, he doesn't let it go there. You know, he keeps it balanced throughout the rest of it.
Yeah, and at that point, it felt very heavily like they were going to go that way. And it's set up that way, basically, throughout the whole book. One thing to give a little perspective for people, and this was in Sean Murphy's note on the book, which I think comes at the end. I'm trying to check real quick of the trade paperback. Is it at the end of it where he talks about his motivation?
Well, I have the deluxe edition right now. And, yeah, there's a page that tells him or tells the reader that he got inspiration to write his own comic when he was in a dumpster in Hollywood. So.
That's interesting. So that's actually different than the one in my book. My book is it's the trade paperback, and he starts this little letter with, I stopped praying in 2003, and then he goes to tell the story of he had been working on doing this. He went he was living with a friend in Colorado, went to California on a surfing trip, and he was a devout Catholic, and he ended up in the process of this trip turning – I forget if he says he's atheist or agnostic. Atheist. Yeah, so he says he turned atheist. So this is being written by somebody who was raised and lived a devout Catholic and then became an atheist. And that's what made the book fall into place, because he was trying to write it and it wasn't really working. But he wasn't going the way he wanted it to go. But yeah, so to get back to the book, we'll just kind of set up, because I think when we get to that point where he turns into a punk rocker, that's really the key turning point of the story. Yeah, so Slate tries to kill Chris's twin that they don't let anybody know existed, but the doctor, do you recall the doctor's name?
Sarah Epstein.
So Dr. Sarah follows him, sees what's going on, and that's all they show there. Then they jump back to what's going on, the people protesting, Thomas kicking their butts. Some of those scenes are pretty entertaining, especially because Thomas is strictly non-lethal, which later on you find out why. Right. So they just go through a lot of, like, Ophis, Slate, they really look bad. They're trying to raise Chris to think that he's Jesus, to think that he could do miracles. That causes problems. Public backlash causes them to put him in a public school. Also going on at this time, it turns out that Dr. Sarah had a daughter. So that daughter is being raised alongside Chris, but the daughter goes home with Sarah each night, so she's not living at this J2 complex. But they're being raised together. The daughter has no problem adapting to social environments when they go to public school, whereas Chris can't adapt. Plus, he always has big, scary Thomas with him. He grows up. The mom is having lots of problems because this is a screwed-up environment for an 18-year-old to be injected into. So you see, she's not a good mom, but with the environment that is set up for her, how is she supposed to be expected to, like, become an adult and be a good mom? So she wants to get Chris out of there. She gets more and more unhinged as it goes on. Her parents disappear. They never really explain that.
Yeah.
So yeah, her life gets screwed up. Chris grows up. They throw his mom out, basically. Chris starts rebelling at that point, but then he starts rebelling by educating himself about everything that he can. And there's a lot of that going on. His mom ends up getting killed. She joins with the religious what are they called? Do you recall offhand what they're called, Jay?
They call themselves
NAC.
Yeah, NAC, New American Christians.
Yeah,
yep.
New American Christians. Yeah, so they're representing the, like, extreme religious right. And Chris's mom ends up joining with them, and then when they basically plan a siege to go and get Chris out of J2, Chris's mom gets killed, and that's definitely the major turning point. That's where he is just ready to prepare himself to get out of there, and he starts listening to punk music, reading everything.
Awesome.
And then he escapes and becomes a punk. So the funniest thing, this was one of the other parts that we get to, and I'm kind of like, this is a little too easy, where he just goes to this punk concert, and I'm going to be your lead singer now. Okay. But I guess everybody also makes it make sense. Everybody knew who he was, because it's actually what are these award shows?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why punks would watch a, like, reality TV show, because, you know, like, the guitarist, was it? He actually knew Thomas, and he seemed like he watched the TV show. That doesn't really seem very punk to me.
Go for it, Jay.
All right. Yeah, but as far as the punk, I didn't have as much trouble accepting that, you know, believing that part of it was, okay, he suddenly becomes the singer for this punk band. Because,
yeah,
I mean, he's a well-known character, and, you know, hey, what band wouldn't like the publicity of having, a notable person in, you know, simply for public relations, especially when he's becoming a rebellious, that type. And as far as, I don't know, the connection to Thomas, I know that fairly early on in the book, there was a scene where Thomas was talking to Tim, who is a character we really don't know much about. He shows up with Gwen, who's the mother. He was ostensibly there for, you know, doing technical support, but we don't really get, I don't really get what his relationship to Gwen was.
He's just there for tech support in the show. I mean, he's just there working.
Yeah.
But they also, they hinted at some sort of romantic undertones between he and Gwen. But
really?
There was a, very subtle, but there was a scene early on where he's talking to, trying to make friends with Thomas, and Thomas is listening to Punk. I forgot what the name of the group was. So we see that he's had, he's had this, he has this background. So him knowing a punk rock guitarist doesn't sound, I mean, I can see the connection there. It was a little subtle, but there are some unexplained things in this. Those type of things don't tend to bother me. I'm not the type of person that has to have every little thread followed along in comics, but there's some things that aren't really fully fleshed out.
Well, the thing about that, him joining that punk band, he's supposed to be the second coming of Jesus, right?
That's what they're touting him as, yes.
Yeah, so like, how punk rock is that to have Jesus rebel against, you know, everybody? I actually find that, you know, like, I think they would want that.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Well, yeah, of course they would. So they would want it. They want the publicity. One of the things that I think is a little bit odd about the punk band is that they stress that this is the last punk band, which is one of those things where they're, like, throwing us out into this, like, time, but they're not setting up, like, why are they the last punk band? You know, what is going on in the music world? They've set up with Opus and J2 that, you know, this is clearly, like, really being taken over by the lengths that they're going to go to for a reality show. So that sets the tone for that, but that's never really been set with music. So then for them to suddenly say, this is the last punk band. The context of, like, why are they the last punk band? Why do they want to be a punk band? Do they really want to rebel? If they want to rebel, why are they taking the opportunity for something that's going to get them massive mainstream attention?
True.
If they're the last punk band wanting to rebel, why would they care? There's a lot of stuff like that. It didn't bother me in the flow of the story at all, but I did think it was a little, you know, one of those things where they're telling a 15, 16-year story in 6 issues. They're not going to be able to tell everything, so you just accept that. But that was one of those where, one of the moments where it's just, okay, you just take that with a leap of faith and move on. Yeah, they're pretty excited. Well, some of them are pretty excited to have him. I believe it's the drummer that wasn't too excited about it. And it is his girlfriend that ends up dying in all of this process. So they become this massive punk band. Everybody's very excited. They're going to go perform in Israel. So they're out to rebel. The NAC is out to stop them. They have run-ins with them. Stuff gets crazier and crazier. Before they actually go to perform they go to perform in Jerusalem. So up to that point, before we get to that point, because that's definitely a big changing point in the story, they're battling against the NAC, dealing with the protests, all this stuff. Is there anything in that section of the book before they go to Jerusalem that really stands out to you guys?
Actually, I was going to mention that the doctor's daughter, you know what I was thinking? That probably was his twin sister, Chris's.
Oh, I think
it's... And she saved him.
I think it is, without question. In fact, she says that later on in the book. We learned that.
Yeah, they explicitly say that at the end of the book. I don't think Eric quite got to the end of it, but yeah, at the end they explicitly reveal that is his sister.
Okay.
But, I mean, it seemed, even when they first introduced the idea, when she was saying, oh, yo, Chris is going to have a playmate, it was pretty obvious, at least to me, that she wasn't really pregnant. She had somehow rescued.
Because they go up to her, it's like, so nobody knows she was pregnant and carried a baby to term. Plus, she was barren. She's like, oh, well, I'm a doctor. I figured it out.
Right.
Yeah, that was...
So, yeah, I mean, it was pretty obvious. It was pretty convenient for her to suddenly have a baby at the same time.
Right.
But I was just saying, we were talking about the time frame.
Yeah.
For early on, and like I think it's on page 6, when we first see our first drawing of Thomas as an adult, there's a billboard in the background that says, "Are you ready for the second coming, Christmas of 2019?
2019,
so this is roughly running from 2020 to 2035, 36.
35, yep.
So near future, but not distant future. But which allows him to do, I think, all that stuff, you know, like the flood plain, or that people were displaced by the flood, a little bit of an aside there. But as far as that section for their battling against the NAC, it was integral to the story, but I don't think it was not a part that I found, you know, all that compelling.
Yeah, I think that section of the story was doing a lot to set the tone for what was coming next. The transition from Chris, you know, the conflict for a long time was Chris being in J2 and being contained, and the conflict with his mother, and then she's killed. So a lot of conflict there, and so the resolution was he, you know, escapes basically, and then joins this punk band. So that's kind of setting the tone a little bit and transitioning to the next major point of the story, where they go to perform in Jerusalem. So this is a huge security risk. They're risking, you know, their lives. I think it's very important and all that. So right before they announce it, I think is the line of the book that really says it all, where Chris is talking to Thomas, and Chris is saying how important all this stuff is, and Thomas is just want to protect him, basically. He says to Chris, "Blind idealism did this to me and is doing it to you. There's still time for one of us to make peace." So blind idealism is what set Thomas up to go through the life that he went through. You know, he was a kid and his parents got killed. Supposedly they were in the NRA and the IRA and got killed by the other side. We come to find out later on in the book, when they flesh out all of Thomas's story, that they were trying to leave the IRA because of what life it was setting up for their son. And it was his uncle that came and killed his parents. And when he discovered that, because he was a very successful killer in the IRA, and then when he realized that they didn't care about anything and they were going to allow a school bus of children to be blown up in one of their attacks, Thomas tried to drive the bus away. It still blew up the back edge of the bus and killed one child. And then when the police got him in custody, they showed a videotaped confession from his father. So black and white evidence, like absolute proof that his father was not trying to join the NRA. He had joined, but he was trying to separate from it. So that really changed it all. And he has a vision telling him not to kill anymore. So that's why through the whole book, he won't kill anybody. So he's getting more and more conflicted because he promised Chris's mother to protect him. Chris's mother is the same that it was his vision. It's, you know, his vision years later, he sees Chris's mother and it's this person, you know, to him. So he's conflicted between he promised not to kill her, he's going to go to hell. And now he promised Chris's mother to protect him, and it's getting impossible to do both.
Right. Yeah. That's why I seems clear to me that Thomas is the central character of this story. The book opens with him, and it closes with him. He's also the only one that really, I think, undergoes any significant change. Chris does, but he, you know, becomes rebellious based on his circumstances. But it's, you know, it's not anything that we would consider, or I don't consider it to be, what you find in a lot of literature, where this character undergoes a lot of changes and has some revelation and understands a little bit about who he is. I don't think we ever get to see that with Chris. He doesn't, I'm not giving too much away, he doesn't live long enough, you know, to have that revelation. So it's really the story about Thomas. And, you know, and it's a tragic, heartbreaking character, because here's a man who's, like I said, was it like Chris, victim of his circumstances, of his upbringing, you know, brought to be a certain way, realized what he was doing, you know, tried to move away from it, but still carried this tremendous, crushing guilt and remorse for his early life. And I think that's why he was so bent on protecting Chris, and why he was he believed in Chris. You know, there's a couple times in that where people ask him, do you really think that he's the second coming of Christ? And
yeah.
Thomas always said, yes. I think that was what he was clinging on to, because if it's true, then here's his chance at redemption and forgiveness. You know, without getting into, and I don't want to get too much into the religious overtones here. But I mean, that's, you could, we can't escape it. I mean, they're weaving through this.
Yeah.
And you see that as part of Thomas's journey, is what he's trying to get, you know, move past and find some kind of peace for his former life. And it's
right.
It looks like it's just a tragic story. In so many ways, it's tragic for Chris. It's tragic for Thomas. It's tragic for Gwen.
For Gwen, yeah.
particularly.
Wow.
And the other character that I was wanting to kind of ask people, what did people think of this doctor, the Sarah Epstein, who supposedly did, you know, cloned the DNA? What type of,
yeah.
What did you feel about her character?
I was actually going to mention her and say that she really stood out for me, because I think she was the big drive for, like, influencing Gwen and even Thomas, and actually, yeah, Chris, like, when she showed him the scientific stuff. So
yeah, I think she was for, next to Thomas, I think she may have been the most important character in the book.
Oh yeah.
She's driven by science, so she's driven by reason. You know, there's emotion involved in her throughout the book, but it's not like her disbased really. She's more, whereas pretty much everybody else aside from Slate, I guess, is driven by reacting to their environment. So the reason that Thomas is a more important character than like Chris is Thomas has been on a path because of his environment his whole life, but he has perspective to see what's going on now and not just write it. Whereas Chris, he's young. He hasn't had these experiences before. He's way too much just holding on to the wave of what's happening and trying to write it as hard as he can. I mean, being extremely idealistic. And Thomas is, he has the perspective to see how faulty extreme idealism is. Sarah is the other one that has more perspective on that. She's been through stuff. She had a failed marriage because she couldn't have a baby. That's a very traumatic mm-hmm. experience that changed her life a lot. Her biggest goal is to produce this algae that is going to save the world, basically. that sets us out into the future some too, where the world is obviously in worse shape. So her purpose is noble, and she realizes that there are sacrifices mm-hmm. that have to be made, because she has to be able to take advantage of this conglomerate to be able to do this research. Their big threat on her is that if she doesn't go along with what she has to go along with, they're going to kill all of her work, which wouldn't just be stopping her and then she has to start up again, but it would be setting her back for, like 8 years, a long period of time. And she's so close. So that's a big turning point later on in the book, is she accomplishes what she set out to do. I love the part towards the end of the book where there's almost nobody left at the J2 compound. And Slate is talking to her and says, oh, you're almost done, aren't you? And she says, yep. She says, so I guess you and your employees basically will be gone soon. She says, yep. So she's almost out of there. She's almost done what she's had to do. And then that's when she's ready to lower the boom on Slate, because she knows that he attempted murder on a baby. She rescued the baby, which that's clearly revealed later, but it's pretty obvious early on that's what happened. So yeah, I think she's a very important character, and she gives a lot of perspective. And you get caught up in the story. Like, the first read of this story, you read through and you're caught up in the heat of everything that's going on. You know, it's all about, you know, the mom trying to struggle to get out of there with Chris, because she knows that this is a bad environment and it's killing her. I mean, she was a kid when she went in there, basically. She was just 18 years old, and they put her through plastic surgery, and they did all these things to make her fit an image, never caring about the person. They didn't care that she was dealing with depression. They didn't care that she was becoming an alcoholic and all these different things.
They gave him her the alcohol. They gave her.
Yeah, yes. Slate was slipping her the alcohol, which was supposed to be forbidden in the J2 complex. So I mean, they never cared about her. They were setting it up to run her into the ground. That's just a plus for ratings too. So you're writing all of that, and then, you know, Chris, his mom gets killed. He's just going to get out and burn the world down. And, you know, the point that Jay and I mentioned where I was a little iffy on the book was where he breaks out and I guess it was at the Grammys. And then when he first joins the punk band and he's just, you know, completely anti-religion, I was worried that was going to be the trajectory of the book from that point. But that was just another point where it's this extremism, this trajectory following his idealism that was too extreme. And you see Thomas pulling back from that. You would think that was along kind of a similar path that he wouldn't mind, but you know, and you get that line just that, you know, extreme idealism is the problem of everything. They go to Jerusalem. Thomas is trying to talk him out of it. Chris thinks that this is so important, they just got to at least do this one last thing. And that one last thing was the beginning of the downfall. The girl in the band gets killed. They barely escape otherwise. Thomas has to kill people to save them, so now he's broken his vow. They go back. Chris ends up getting killed by J2. Or not J2, I'm sorry, by the NAC. So, I mean, that kind of comes, you know, full circle with Chris. And then the end of the book, it's about Thomas, and it's about Sarah. And I guess, you know, to an extent about Rachel. Rachel was the one that survived. So what do you guys think about the conclusion? How does this pull everything back in?
Before I get to that, I just want to say I'm finding myself a little more critical of Sarah than the other of you two, because I think with the exception of Slate, we kind of have to kick Slate out because he's really almost a character, kind of a stereotype of corporate.
Yeah,
yeah. He's a trope, for sure.
Of all the characters, I found her the least likable. And it's kind of what you said. Yes, she's doing all these things, trying to better humanity, but she ultimately puts her research into this algae that she's trying to engineer, bioengineer this super algae that accelerates the photosynthesis process so that it will take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and create oxygen to counteract the greenhouse effect. And even at towards the end there, where she's talking to Thomas, and she admits to Thomas that, you know, that Rachel is, she saw Slate inject the baby with that sedative or whatever to try to kill it and then dump it. She admits all that, and Thomas is like, why didn't you tell me this? Had we known this, we could have used this. We could have stopped this. And she says, all but says, yes, but it would have ended all my research. So, whether you consider it noble or not, she did. There's no getting around the fact, I think, that, yes, she did put her research ahead of the well-being of some of these other characters.
Yeah, and that's where I think...
Maybe I'm being a little too harsh with that, but that's like, you know...
No, I think you're correct with that. In her mind, she's doing the necessary thing, but she's risking the life of a girl that she's raised as her daughter, that she knows Slate tried to murder. She's risking the life of Chris, who, you know, at the time when, you know, going back to the beginning, Slate tried to murder a baby. Like, how is this kid safe? You know, and that kid's a baby. You know, the life of Chris's mother, who ends up getting killed, and pretty much everybody, you know, there's no proof, but it's obvious that Slate intentionally shut the security door on her and killed her.
Oh yeah, no, it said it in increased pressure on the screen.
Yeah, so it's you know, I mean, she did the thing that she thought was a necessary thing, but you know, if you look in the grand scheme of things, you could say that the right and wrong of her choices, like, well, if this is gonna save the world, then, you know, when you get to the end and that's the end result, like, okay, maybe that was worth it. But when you're looking at the choices all throughout, like, all throughout, she's making choices that are not morally correct choices. And how similar is she to Slate? Like, Slate is very intentionally, like, just does not care about morals. But she's sacrificing morals all throughout, too. She's not the one making the decision to murder a baby. But she also knows that somebody attempted murder on a baby and doesn't do anything. She doesn't want to disrupt her funding. So she's a pretty despicable character when you really look at it.
I think Slate would have killed the baby had he known. That's the thing. Like, had she told him?
Oh, if probably, he could, well, yeah, he probably. It's hard.
Or
to,
even her.
It's hard to say. Well, yeah.
But maybe that he attempted murder, she could have gone to the authorities with that, and Slate would have gone to prison for attempted murder.
Possibly.
That's the difference.
There were no witnesses. See, there was no evidence, unless she could have gotten some. So.
Everything is being recorded. Like, I assumed that her being there, she was recording what was going on. Because at the end of the book, she had proof that he did it in some way, shape, or form, and I don't know. Either way, she definitely was not a purely positive character.
No, I don't want to paint her as evil either, but I mean, it's like... There's a lot of moral ambiguity with her character, which there is with all of us in life.
Everybody.
So I wasn't trying to, make her out as to be an anti-hero or an evil person. I'm just, pointing out, it's like, there are not really many, even Thomas, who's I think is the most admirable character, that, he's not without his flaws. He's just done things and he would do things again. And we see at the end, although it, is the last act that he does in this book. while it may seem like, justice being served, is it, is it really? How do you think about it? How do you approach that?
I really want this to be made into a movie. It would be a good movie. I haven't really
thought about it. It may or may not. It's very possible. It could be.
It'd either be really good or really bad. It would depend on who got their hands on it.
Yeah, because I feel like Sean Murphy, the way he transitioned from past and present. It kind of felt like a movie to me. And, it feels really real. Just the whole story. And like you said, just all the characters, they all have, human traits that are relatable. So I feel he did really well with that.
I agree. As I said at the beginning, I think this is just, it's a damned intelligent book.
When it comes down to it, I think that, like I said, that one line sums it up. But this book was very much exposing what happens with extreme idealism. We didn't even get that much into talking about the NAC, but there are some strong characters in the NAC. The one woman who is the figurehead of it in the book, she's just another example of the extreme idealism. And as we read through this book, some things seem obvious, the NAC, they're bad because they're opposed to J2, which we know isn't really good necessarily, but our protagonist is aligned with J2, so we're set up to feel that way to start with. And just throughout it, we're always kind of being shifted around with, this person is too extreme, so there's something bad there. And the whole book is kind of shifting it around. The one person that's always kind of the more steady thread throughout is Thomas, and he's lived through extreme idealism and realized how corrosive that is, and he's just trying to protect what he can around him from what he sees as important. When we got to that point where, to me, it became clear that was the central theme and purpose of the book, that's when it went from being like, okay, well, this is an interesting story, to like, I had a lot stronger feeling about it at that point.
I agree, and I think that's what Murphy was trying to accomplish with this. Like I said, you talked a little bit about his personal journey. He could have made this, and I'm sure he was trying to work out in the writing of this, work out a little bit of his own, journey and through life, and writers do that. That's why they become writers to begin with, is to try to work out things. And a lot of, I don't want to say that Thomas or was necessarily a biographical character, but I think a lot of what I suspect a lot of what Murphy was dealing with himself got woven into some of the characteristics of Thomas. Kind of what he's going
through. Yeah, definitely. It definitely seems like it, especially with him saying in that little postscript note that it was him having this conversion from being a devout Catholic to being an atheist that made his ideas for the book fall into place. Like, that falls in a, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Thomas, I guess, is still a devout Catholic through the whole book, but he sees the flaws in the extremity of things. But yes, this was a good one, Jay. I'm glad that you wanted to do this, because this was a book that I've known about for a long time, but I don't know if I ever would have read it if you didn't bring it up for this. I'm glad I did now.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it, and I hope other people, listen to this and have an interest to it. And I would say to anybody who's potentially thinking about it, don't let the religious aspect of this put you off, because it's not really, Murphy's not pushing one agenda here, one position on anything. Yes, there's some religious aspects to it. It's part of the nature of the story, and you can't get away from it, but it's not anything you should be afraid of.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
If you like good storytelling that's complex, intelligent, and if you like some of the most sublime artwork that you could get, I can sit here and talk all night about Murphy's artwork. It's stunning to me. Well, you can see what it does, how it influences, especially with Garrett, because Garrett has been on record for saying he doesn't like some of the, more, I don't want to use the word sketchy.
Yep.
I hate this word sketchy, because that's a totally, not, but, not very, not hyper-realistic art. Plus,
yeah.
He's also preferred, he doesn't prefer black and white comics over colors. So, but to get him, for someone like that, to become enamored with this book, I think speaks to its appeal. And I'm gonna shut it now before I start gushing over Sean Murphy.
Well, man,
I really love it.
The art is just sorry, I don't know how much longer we're doing this, but there were a few things that I noticed about the art that I thought were really cool. For example, that page with the billboard. And it transfers from Thomas when he was young, transitions
right.
from Thomas when he was younger to when he's older. I noticed on his face, there's actually fingerprints for dirt. That is a very cool detail.
Right.
And I think he's the only character with the fingerprints on his face.
I don't recall seeing any others, but...
sometimes he had paint strokes. Or, just strokes across the page. He loves, and you can tell, he loves drawing cars and vehicles.
Yeah. Oh, and, certainly motorcycles, too. You see that also. That's in Tokyo Ghost.
Tokyo
You've Ghost. Noticed that.
Yep.
He's got an affinity for motorcycles. He loves to draw those.
Yeah, Thomas and Led in Tokyo Ghost, both big, huge guys on badass motorcycles, pretty much sums it up.
Yep.
But I do think this is going to be where we're going to wrap it up for tonight. We'll have to have a whole episode dedicated to gushing over Sean Murphy's art at a later time.
Absolutely.
you can tweet the show at CBW Podcast. Jay, what's your Twitter handle?
I'm at Jay Forgets.
And Garrett, what's your Twitter handle?
It is Yo Gazza Gazza. Yo Gabba Gabba. Just, yeah.
I'm on Twitter at Who's Paul. You can find us all if you're in the Slack group. The Slack group, you can find us there. But we're also on the Valiant Central Facebook group to go along with my other podcast. You can email us at cbwpodcast@outlook.com if you have any ideas or questions, comments, that sort of thing. Next time we will be reading Essex County. Jay and Ronnie should be joining us for that. It'll definitely be Jay and myself. But so check out Essex County, great Jeff Lemire book. Jeff Lemire is one of my favorite writers, and I think a lot of us feel that way. And that's that was, I think, the book that definitely put me over the top with Jeff Lemire. So until next time, check out some Essex County, and then after that, we're going to be getting into a big old podcast. A bunch of people want to join up for ElfQuest. So coming a little bit down the road, we'll be having some ElfQuest. Yeah. So until next time, thank you again for joining me, guys, and have a good night.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.
That was pathetic. Ooh.
Nerdy Legion.
All right, and now this is where my producer puts in some good outro music.
That doesn't really seem very punk to me.
No, I'm in Maine, far, far away from there.
Yeah, and I'm going to rip your throat out.
Fingerprints on his face.
Valley Central. Ha ha ha.